Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, whoever said the early bird gets the worm wasn't kidding, at least when it comes to smarts. A new study from Norway published in the journal Science shows that oldest brothers' IQ scores, they only tested this on boys, so oldest brothers' IQ scores are on average 3 points higher than their next youngest sibling. So not only does your older brother seem older, smarter, and stronger given his head start, he really is smarter, at least statistically. We are joined now by the lead author of the study, Peter Christensen, an epidemiologist at the University of Oslo, and by Frank Sulloway, a psychologist at the Institute of Personality and Social Research at the University of California, Berkeley, who has also long studied the effects of birth order, to discuss what this means and what it doesn't mean, and what about all those other forms of intelligence. Welcome, both of you, to WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Professor Christensen, let me start with you, and I want to mention that other studies have also shown an IQ advantage in being firstborn, but not definitively. So what did your study show that was new?
Well, in a sense, we have sorted out some of the explanations that have been proposed on this effect. One is the possibility that this might be an artifact that really would have nothing to do with the birth order as such. And the other is the possibility that this might be a gestational or biological effect. I believe we have sorted out or given quite firm evidence that neither of those two explanations hold.
How significant, Professor Sulloway, is 2 to 3 IQ points, which is all that the difference is that was found here? What does that mean, and what is it really measuring?
Well, two or three IQ points may not seem like much, but it has a much greater influence than most people realize. For example, the chances of a firstborn getting into a better college or university are about 13% higher than they would be for a secondborn, just based on those 2 or 3 IQ points. And the odds of the firstborn getting in are
about
30%.
Well, let me stop you right there. You say just based on those 2 or 3 IQ points. How do we know it's not also based on other things? Differential personality development, you know, that stems from the way first and secondborns interact with each other or whatever.
Well, in this example, I'm just imagining that colleges are basing admissions purely, say, on SAT scores. Now, the point you're making is quite valid. There are other things going on that are associated with these birth order differences that have to do with differences in, for example, conscientiousness and work habits and so forth. And we have, from the literature on birth order, well-documented differences there as well.
We're going to open up the phones on this and our comments page because I know this has been the buzz of the parent dumb among almost anybody I've been speaking to who has more than one kid, and even some who have only children wondering where they fit in. So if you are a parent or if you are a former child, you may call at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, as we talk about this birth order and IQ study that so many people are talking about, 212-433-9692. Professor Christensen, tell us a little bit more about the study. Who exactly did you study, and why was it only boys?
Well, all young men in Norway has to do military service, and before they join the army, they have to take these draft tests, examinations, and this IQ test is one of those. And since women do not join the armed forces in Norway, we have no women.
So it was an easy sample to use in this case, the boys. Would you expect any different results for girls?
We have to rely then on other studies where both genders have been studied. And as far as I know, there are not very large differences. It seems to be very much the same. The birth order effect is there for girls and for boys.
And Professor Soloway, is there any reason to think these results would be different in different countries or different along class lines or anything like that?
There are many other large and fairly well-controlled studies, not as beautifully designed as the new Norwegian study, that do show systematic birth order differences in other countries. So we don't have any obvious reason to expect any significant differences from one country to another.
In the nature versus nurture battle, Professor Soloway, nature's been winning for a while with all the new neuroscience studies and DNA findings and everything. Doesn't this study strike a blow for nurture? In other words, you know, it's almost like everything people tend to assume about IQ is wrong, which is that it's something that you're born with. We're finding from this study that IQ is something that is a function of your experience in life as an older or younger sibling, at least to some degree.
Well, you're quite right that these findings do indicate an environmental source for variance in IQ. However, we have known for many decades from twin studies, behavioral genetic studies, that somewhere between a third and a half of the variance in IQ is environmental. Yes, genes are important, and they get a lot of headlines in the news sometimes, but we know that that the environment has a very significant influence on IQ, and birth order turns out to be something that's adding a somewhat modest but interesting component to that environmental influence.
Well, did the people who first developed IQ as a measure of something believe that, or did they think they were measuring something genetic with IQ, and now we've learned over time that it isn't that simple?
Well, when the test was first being developed, I don't think the proponents were concerned about the genetic or environmental sources of intelligence. They just wanted to measure it, and as the test became more perfected and so on, people began looking at genetic sources, and so the whole controversy over nature versus nurture postdates the development of the IQ test by many, many decades.
Let's take a phone call first from somebody who may be feeling really disadvantaged by this finding, Laura in Harlem. Laura, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Yeah, I'm the youngest of 13, so I'm wondering where that leaves me, because I always felt it was quite an advantage because I hung out with people who are always older than me and had the advantages of, you know, learning from them.
Professor Christensen?
Well, first I would like to say that our study is an epidemiological study. It's a population-based study that gives you the large numbers, and it's very difficult from that study to tell anything about the individual case. It is the individual case that people are concerned about, but you see that we haven't studied birth orders this far, but there are several aspects here. I believe that you would also have to take into account the time span between the eldest and the youngest, and we see that if this time span is long, it seems like almost you can start anew, because the difference tend to shrink when the...
So if you have your first child 1 year and then your second child, say, 10 years later, it's almost like you're raising two only children or two firstborns with the types of interactions with the parents that take place. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, our results support such an idea.
And, yeah. And also, I believe, even more relevant to Laura's case, that the results were less pronounced in bigger families in your study, right? So the firstborn IQ differential was smaller the more siblings there were. Is that correct?
That's correct. We only did this study in some detail for the first five children. So anything beyond five is, well, you have small numbers,
right.
and the the robustness of the data are not there.
Laura, what are you thinking as the youngest of all those sibs?
Well, what he says sounds true in a way, because it's like we have 2.5 families within my family. We break down in different ways. And certainly there is sort of a strange break in the middle of it, and it does seem to start again. So I'm sort of pleased to hear that.
Laura, thanks a lot. And Larry in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Larry.
Yeah, hi. I'm a clinical psychologist in the city, and I haven't read the research, and I don't keep up with the research in the field. However, there are a couple of things that have bothered me about the discourse on this.
Mm-hmm.
People are talking about, you know, there are real hard statistical findings. That's fine. But the clinical significance, as I think some of your questions are getting at, is really something that researchers don't really get at all that well. Also, people are talking about the test, the IQ test. There are many IQ tests. They all have different standard deviations. And if I remember correctly from my graduate training, that over time, the accuracy of an IQ test gets better. That is, if you're an adult and you are tested and then retested at some other point, it's more likely that that IQ test number will remain stable. And that, I believe, is because it's more difficult to ascertain those numbers, you know, to get at the different kinds of intelligence.
Right. Well, Larry, thank you for your call. And what about the different kinds of intelligence, Professor Soloway? Aren't there, you know, we're so much more sophisticated, I think, now as a society in our meaning, in our understanding of what intelligence means. I mean, people just used to think about IQ. Now we know through the work of Howard Gardner and Daniel Goleman and others that there's emotional intelligence and social intelligence. And, you know, my own observation is often the younger siblings might tend to have more social intelligence than the elders.
Yes, this is a very good point. You know, IQ is not everything you want to know about intelligence in the broadest sense. There are so many other things that contribute to sort of adaptive functioning in the world, and social intelligence is just one of those. It is interesting to note, by the way, that some research on birth order has shown that younger siblings are better when they're children at a thing called anticipating theory of mind. In other words, they're better at understanding what is in someone else's mind going on. And that is something we actually would expect. As a younger sibling, you have less power. And so it makes sense to be better at sort of empathizing with the thought processes of another person, to know what they're thinking and what they may be doing to you or planning to do to you. And so there is research showing that in this other small component of intelligence, that younger siblings seem to have a bit of an advantage.
So, Professor Christensen, having a 2 or 3 point higher IQ, which is what your study found on average for the oldest siblings, doesn't necessarily predict success in life relative to the younger siblings, does it?
No, not at all. One thing is what the IQ score mean. Another thing is that this small difference tell very little on the individual level. I mean, if you have two siblings, the older and the younger, there would be a bit more than 50% probability that the elder would be the best one. But there's still more than 40% probability that it's the youngest who will be the best one.
Mm-hmm.
So it will not predict very good. It's a very poor predictor, in fact. But the significance of this finding is on the population level. As Dr. Soloway stated, it has consequences on the population level concerning educational attainment, and we have data that we want to follow up. It's not published yet, but we will follow it up, and it certainly has some consequences for educational attainment.
So when we continue in a minute, I want to ask the two of you what implications you think it has for educational instruction. In other words, I'm sure that parents and educators have an interest in not disadvantaging anybody. So if they know that the second sibling tends to turn out with a lower IQ, what is it that parents might do or schools might do to compensate for that and help equalize the educational outcome? So we'll talk about that when we continue on the finding that birth order affects IQ. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Some things coming up this week. Tomorrow, I'll be interviewing Mayor Bloomberg. Thursday, Schools Chancellor Joel Klein. Friday, we'll have excerpts from the next Democratic presidential hopefuls debate. So a lot to listen to every morning this week at 10 a.m. We continue now to talk about that study that is so much the buzz about birth order and IQ. It found in a nutshell that older siblings have a roughly 2 to 3 IQ point advantage over younger siblings in general, at least the boys and young men studied in this particular Norwegian study. And we're talking about the implications of that with the lead author of the study, Petter Christensen, an epidemiologist at the University of Oslo, and Frank Sulloway, a psychologist at UC Berkeley, who is a birth order expert and wrote an accompanying editorial in the journal Science where this was published. Let's go to some of the implications for what people should do. I mentioned at the beginning, Professor Sulloway, that somebody I know, when talking about this study to me the other day, said, well, gosh, you know, I immediately started reading extra to my younger child. Do you think that that's the right response to this?
No, my advice to parents is relax. First of all, it's a modest IQ difference. Secondly, we don't entirely know the reason for the difference, and it's difficult perhaps to even think about remedying it unless you know the mechanism. But thirdly, what I would do as a parent, if I'm going to do anything, is simply to encourage the kinds of abilities that each child has, and firstborns tend to be good at some things, and laterborns tend to be good at other things. So, okay, if your firstborn is a little better at school and maybe has a slightly higher IQ, that's fine. But probably your younger siblings in the family are good at alternative things, and simply give them the encouragement they need to maximize those abilities. And if you do that, you're doing a wonderful job as a parent.
But let's go through some of the theory of why this even happens, why oldest kids would come out with higher IQs. I've read, for example, that they get more adult conversation. Obviously, they would get that before additional siblings are born. And then there's a theory that they spend time teaching their younger siblings. And so that's not as effective education as what the younger siblings could have gotten directly from the parents. Do you buy any of that?
Well, all of these are candidate explanations, and on top of those two, we have a third candidate, which is niche partitioning in the family, the tendency for firstborns, for example, to occupy the niche of a surrogate parent and to do the kinds of things that parents value, like getting good grades at school. And so all of these are on the table as explanations for what's going on.
Professor Christensen, where are you on that? And here's another one. You've read about how parents, in trying to make things fair, therefore shortchange middle children.
Well, I'm not a psychologist, and in our study, we did not have any data on these family dynamics.
Right. So I'm sorry, it was Professor Sulloway who wrote that.
Well, I think it's intriguing and very interesting to listen to Dr. Sulloway on this, because I believe these are the explanations that are left when we have given evidence against.
Well, let me go back to Professor Sulloway, because actually my mistake. It's you who wrote about how parents, in trying to make things fair, necessarily shortchange middle children, correct?
Yes, that's right. There's an irony in the fact that if parents treat their offspring exactly equally, the middle children end up getting the short end of the stick, and that's because there's a time when firstborns are the only member of the family and they get extra attention, and there's a time when the lastborn is the only one living in the home. And so if parents are treating offspring equally, middle children are always sharing equally with someone else, and they never have a time when they get a little extra because they're the lone child in the family. And so if you're a parent and you really want to treat your children equally in the truest sense, you'd have to always give more to the middle child, but the other children wouldn't stand for that, so you can't do it as a parent.
Let's take another call. Maggie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. I just had a comment about the actual difference. I think it was 2 to 3 points difference, and one of your guests acknowledged that that was modest, and it's, to me it seems so modest and so small, such a small effect size, that making so many conclusions and it seems irresponsible or inappropriate to come to any grand conclusions about society and families in general from such a small effect size.
Professor,
what your guess?
Professor Christensen.
Well, on the individual level, you're quite right, but on the population level, this small difference matters. You could compare it to studies on blood pressure, for example. Even very small, modest differences between populations will have consequences for those populations on the large scale concerning health. It's the same thing about the small IQ difference and education, I believe.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your call. So, Professor Soloway, on that point, I'm still getting used to this concept that a 2 or 3 point IQ difference could be the difference between getting into an Ivy League school and a state university. It seems too much to me.
Well, we can translate these IQ differences into differences on the SAT test that is taken by people as they're preparing to enter college. And the 2.3 difference that has been documented in the large sample in the New Norwegian study is roughly equivalent to 15 points on that SAT test. There are now three of those tests. You combine that, that's 45 points. And if you go and see where the sort of SAT cutoff points are for Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and then other less prestigious colleges, you'll see that that 45 points is the difference between getting into some of the better institutions and not getting into them. So it really does have, at a population level, a significant consequence for who's getting into these colleges and who isn't. And even at the individual level, if you do or don't have those extra 45 SAT points, it makes a difference for you as a person whether you make one of those cutoff points.
Kevin in Chelsea, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Do you hear me well?
Sure do.
Okay. I'm just responding to the woman who was the 13th born.
Mm-hmm.
It was either your show or Mr. Lopate's. There was a pretty broad study that indicated that the last born was often the revolutionary thinker. I remember Napoleon was put in there, I think Karl Marx, but there was a strong indication that lastborn has to fight for the last of the talents and does new things.
And rebels and is therefore the more revolutionary one and often therefore the more creative one. Yeah, we did talk about that on this show with an author who wrote a book to that effect. Professor Soloway, do you buy that theory? Do you think history, including the great thinkers, great rebels, great change artists of history, bear that out?
Yes, there's considerable evidence, historical and otherwise, showing that younger siblings are more likely to be unconventional in their thinking and to lead and support radical revolutions. However, that having been said, I do not believe that birth order is related to creativity in the broad sense, and that's because there's so many different ways to be creative. Firstborns are very creative in lots of ways. They win more Nobel Prizes in science. Laterborns are perhaps more creative in the radical sense of creativity, what I've described sometimes as every century creativity rather than every decade creativity. But one has to be very careful with that term creativity because it obscures differences.
Professor Christensen, here's a question from the comments page of our website. A listener asks, are the siblings from the same mother and father raised in the same home? I wonder if the same results would hold true for step families.
We have looked somewhat into that. Families where the father is not the same for siblings, so they're half siblings. It seems to matter somewhat, not very much, but we didn't publish that, and we haven't gone very far with those findings, but they're extremely interesting.
So what would you recommend for parents or for educators in terms of acting on these findings?
I would say that Dr. Solway's advice was very wise.
His advice was one word, relax.
Yeah, relax and try to develop the abilities that each individual child has.
Professor Soloway, anything more on that?
Well, I find it always interesting how much excitement there is about birth order findings, and it reminds me that, you know, every individual who grew up with a sibling is a birth order theorist, and the topic just... it pushes emotional buttons of all the interactions we had with our siblings when we were young. So,
and not only people who grew up with siblings. Here's another comment from our website. It's a one-line question. It says, "Are only children like eldest children?"
They are to some extent. In the New Norwegian study, when you control for the fact that only children tend to come from broken homes, their IQs are almost as high as firstborns in a family of two, for example, just a tad lower, and that could be explained by the fact that they don't have a younger sibling to tutor, or the fact that they're not niche partitioning into the super smart one in their own family because there's nobody to compete against.
Could a parent who was dead set on equalizing the IQ of two or more siblings do so by certain behaviors?
I'm doubtful, and I think that if parents decided that younger children needed more encouragement to equalize the IQ, the level of unfairness in the treatment of the children would be so apparent to the offspring that all hell would break loose in the family, so I wouldn't recommend it.
They always think it's unfair anyway.
How true.
Professor Christensen, last word. Where does your research go from here? What's your follow-up question?
Well, one thing is the consequences of this birth order effect on IQ. We have the potential to study what kind of consequences this has for educational level, the ability to get into work, income, consequences concerning disability pensioning and such, and we will follow that up.
I've been speaking with Peter Christensen, an epidemiologist at the University of Oslo, the lead author of the study on birth order and intelligence in the journal Science, and with Frank Soloway, a visiting scholar at the Institute of Personality and Social Research at the University of California, Berkeley, who wrote an accompanying editorial in the journal. We have a link to the article on our webpage, but it's free only to Science subscribers. Professor Soloway is also the author of the book, Born to Rebel, Birth Order, Family Dynamics, and Creative Lives, published by Pantheon in the 90s. Thank you both very much for coming on with us this morning.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, a call-in on whether free speech necessarily means no government intervention. Or can the government intervene to enhance free speech? Stay with us.